The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Welcome to Health Matters, the mental health edition. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Vegan, psychologist. My co-host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, is away this evening. We're going to be discussing a really exciting topic tonight, and that is music and music's effect on life enhancement and life development. We have two outstanding guests with us tonight, Dr. Anil Nanda, neurosurgeon and professor and chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at University Neurosurgery, and Krista Fanning, music educator, music teacher at Caddo Middle Magnet, and Grammy Foundation Music Educator Award finalist, and what I call band director extraordinaire. Welcome, Krista, and welcome, Dr. Nanda.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Dr. Nanda, let's start with you. Would you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm a neurosurgeon. I work at University Health at LSU and at Willis-Nine, and been here for several years, and this is one of my interests.
Music.
Yes.
Okay. Krista?
I am a 27-year educator, music educator, taught K through 12 music, and happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have both of you. Thank you both for coming. Let me ask both of you to just start a little bit with these, see if you could answer these questions. Why are you interested in music, and how? What does music do for you personally? And how did you discover music in your lives? Krista, you want to?
I'll go first. I guess I'll start with how I discovered music. I guess my earliest memory is when I was sitting at a little turntable playing the Beatles Revolution. I remember that distinctly. And My Little Corner of the World. And probably a year or two later, I got my own radio and I was listening to Beethoven Symphony No. 5. And I stood on my bed and I started conducting. And that's where my parents knew that there was something going on there. And they surrounded me and my brother with music. So that's how I started there. I can't imagine my life without music at all, and accidentally became a music educator. So, and I was intent on being a music therapist or a performer, and I just discovered music education and knew that I had something to say with young people and music.
What does music do for you?
Oh, it does a world for me. It is my world. It can lift you up. It can calm you down. It can change your mindset. It can just have a profound effect on your entire life, and it has on mine.
Dr. Nanda?
So, you know, I got interested in music through my mother. My mother was a radio star in the state of Punjab in India, and she was like 14 years old, and she would sing on the radio. And she used it as an adjunct to her faith. So I, you know, I loved getting that introduction. And then, as Krista says, everybody loves the Beatles and things like that. So that kind of grew out of that. But to me, it was an amazing adjunct to faith, especially my mother's and my grandmother's. So that was sort of my first. I always thought music was something holy because it made the human soul transcend the ordinary.
Yeah, faith is a good place to start, probably, because I learned most about music in the Catholic Church. And as a little boy, and was exposed to the Gregorian chant. And that's the first real music that I heard about and heard and listened to and participated in and was taught.
So no Beatles?
No Beatles. It was punctums.
Okay.
You know, and whatever other notes there are. You don't have punctums at Caddo Magnet, do you?
No, but I show my students what they are, so they understand.
Punctums.
Yes.
Okay, good. Dr. Nanda, tell us a little bit about faith and music.
Well, I think historically, if you look at it, in every faith, music is a necessary adjunct. You know, you in the Catholic faith, you know, all the polyphony and the Gregorian chants. And in fact, if you look at some of the earlier things, even in the Greek amphitheater, if somebody was sick, they would have these singers come to heal you. Mm-hmm. So music had a wonderful aspect of healing. And, you know, if you look at the Jewish cantors, when they sang, it was always good. And even if you listen to, you know, inshallah, even the Islamic faith, when they say, there's a lot of feeling there. And even in the Hindu faith, you know, they have, you know, they've been singing for thousands of years. And it's an important aspect of that. And I think historically, I mean, they think even Neanderthal man played some music. The oldest musical instrument is about 40,000 years old, and it's the leg of a bear, which had holes in it. It was played like a flute. It was discovered in Slovenia, land of our First Lady, Melania Trump, and that's where that was first discovered and used, you know.
Very, very interesting, yeah. Did you want to comment on...
Well, some of the, that's part of the history lesson in my music classes is some of the first music that was written down is liturgical music. And we travel notation through mostly Catholicism. And that's one of the things that really intrigues me about Catholicism is their use of music. And it's so consistent no matter where you are on the earth. I think that's really intriguing that a religion can have that music all over the globe. And that's not just Catholicism, that's many religions. I find that very intriguing.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Music and faith. So when I think about that, I think that music in the religious context sort of takes one out of the present and moves one to some kind of transcendental reality or some place outside of oneself. But in doing that, to me, there's the effect of presence. So do you have anything to say about
it? I think that's with any type of music, isn't it? It can transcend you from where you are. It can transport you back to a memory that happened when you hear a song from childhood.
No, true. Yeah.
I think music is very evocative. We all know this, you know, we heard, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and mm-hmm. where we were and what, you know, it's associated with an epoch or an area. So it's very nostalgic. And I think that's why people like that. But I think for faith, it's sort of the language of God because it transcends culture, gender, race. You know, it's got a universal appeal to it. You know, you may not be Catholic, but if you listen to the Vespers Mass at Notre Dame Cathedral at 6 in the evening in Paris, there's not a dry eye there mm-hmm. because it's a profoundly mystical experience. It's not a Shirley MacLaine out-of-body experience, but it is a mystical experience.
Let's turn our attention just real quickly because we can come back to so many of these things. What about music in the role of healing, the science of healing? You're a physician. You know, music has a role in treating people who've had strokes. It's an important component in Parkinson's disease. Can you comment on the science of healing and music and medicine?
Yeah, fortunately, there's a lot of data on this. This became very sort of fashionable, or sort of the theory du jour in the 90s when the Mozart effect came out. So they did, the Mozart effect was you do spatial verbal reasoning, you listen to Mozart, and you do better at it. So pregnant women all over the globe were listening to Mozart because they want their kids to be smarter. Mm-hmm. But we have fairly clear-cut data that, you know, if this came from Finland. So in Finland, you had three categories of stroke patients. One category listened to music. Another category just had some audio tape. And the third category had nothing. And the category that listened to music got better. And they showed brain volume increased. So there's a clear-cut therapeutic benefit. And this has been repeatedly found in different studies. And I think you might ask, well, how long, you know, does that mean you're immersed in like a, you know, 3D virtual music system? No, it's 1 hour. This study showed 1 hour. You know, so you wonder, well, if you listen to 6 hours of music, you're going to be smarter. I don't know. But, you know, it's kind of interesting. Yeah.
That's one of the things that intrigued me about music therapy is I read an article when I was a senior in high school, and this is in the mid-80s, about how burn victims healed faster when they were listening to music. And that led me to another study that had to do with what type of music are you listening to in the operating room? Is it something the patient wants to listen to or the doctor wants to listen to? And there was a little bit of a difference in healing time. And so that healing in music, I think there's a direct correlation there.
Do you listen to music in the operating room?
Almost. I mean, we listen to it and I let, you know, I keep it ecumenical, whoever wants to listen.
You listen to
but
Mozart.
I used to listen to a lot of jazz at one time, you know, and I used to, you you know, clip aneurysms to jazz, you know. But I think, you know, it's also the kind of music. Like, they will tell you that Baroque music will bring down your blood pressure. Rock music can give you heart arrhythmias. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, you know, Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water, or something like that. It's sort of got an excitatory type thing, you know, like, so it's not like every music, you know, other music can make you aggressive, like, you know.
Right.
So it's like, you know, so I think you have to see what kind of music it is. And, you know, I think, and, you know, I think it's great historically. I mean, you think about the history of this country. Jefferson wrote the Constitution and the Independence. He apparently used to have complete blank times, and he would play the violin. And when he played the violin, he could write. So, like, great, you know.
Isn't that back when a time when many people played instruments or participated in music?
It was a time when we didn't have so many electronic devices
right.
around us.
Right.
You know, I mean, you think about it, the average teenager spends in the United States over 10 hours on their cell phone. And you have to wonder, maybe better playing the violin for an hour or playing the piano. You know what I mean? That might
right.
work cognitively in terms of your attention span. Now, they know that kids, and you probably know more about this, Krista, that the kids that play in a musical instrument, wall music, their mathematical skills are better. They're cognitively better. They're focused. They have higher IQs.
Yes.
It does make a difference.
Again, we ask you, our listeners, join in, 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Nanda was just talking about focus. Do you see your music students at Middle Magnet who are in the band, are they generally going to do better in their other academic studies because they're in the band? And do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe that there is a focus can be learned. And self-discipline can be taught, and through music it makes it very easy for the student to understand and to know what that feels like so they can apply that to other subjects. Because when you are playing an instrument, you really have to pay attention to what you're doing. You are there doing that. You are living in the moment. And that's a great skill for a whole brain learning.
You know, when you were talking about it earlier, it's when I go snow skiing, I ski to the B-52s. And I don't know what it is about their music, but when I'm playing their music on my headphones and skiing, I ski better. I have no idea why that is.
It's called a performance-enhancing drug.
It is. A performance. Is it legal? It is legal.
It is legal.
Okay. A performance-enhancing drug, the B-52s. Most of our listeners have probably never heard of the B-52s.
I'm sure they have.
They have.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So increased focus. So if I want to sell something to our listeners, I would want to be selling that if they have children in grade school, in elementary, in Middle Magnet, in high school, that being in music programs will enhance their lives, enhance their academic abilities.
Absolutely.
Would you say
without a doubt? I know that my students come to me and they have all kinds of experiences that have nothing to do really with participating in music other than listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to my class and they learn very quickly how to work together, how to get along, how to self-assess, which is a great skill for a young person to have. Their focus is just incredible. And you visited the one class and you saw how focused they were and how quickly we could switch from one activity to another. And it's a great skill for them to have that applies to their other classes. It doesn't shut off when they leave my room. It applies to their other classes because their brain is working at such a high capacity. You can't just do music and just be right-brained. You can't be just left-brained. It's your entire brain.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Dr. Nanda, I did go to her class. And, you know, I was standing in the classroom before the students came in, and they were all coming in, and it was like chaos. And they all were sitting down and getting their instruments ready and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, Krista stepped up to the podium. Everybody got quiet. She made another move. Their instruments went into position, and all of a sudden they started to play. It was unbelievable. It was like from chaos to producing something in a very... That was very appealing.
I need to do that for my neurosurgery residents. Yeah.
Okay. Send it to my room.
Okay.
I'll take care of you.
We have a caller coming in from Shreveport. Robin, you're on. Can you go ahead?
Well, hi. My my son is a student of Miss Fanning. He plays the tuba. And I just wanted to say that, you know, my mother got us in band in fourth grade when I grew up. And I remember being in high school. I wasn't the greatest musician. I was a stronger math student, but I remember thinking as I played the music that this is math. It struck me that when we played, we were doing fractions. And that's why I always thought it was important to have my children involved in music, because I felt like it really stimulated their brains to think on a different, with a different medium. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a different perspective.
Yeah, and you can use, I guess, numbers. I mean, music is numbers, and you can use numbers to make something beautiful. I just thought, you know, why wouldn't every parent want their kid to do music?
Did Charlie tell you about the day we played Pi on March 14th? He'll have to find his music and show you. We used numbers to play music.
So, and I appreciate, I go to the symphony and I see Dr. Nanda there with his wife, and so I know that music is just, it enhances everyone's lives as far as in so many different ways, just relaxation. And I always tell people that's kind of when I feel the closest to God, is when I hear music, because it's just, it's a miracle. What, you know, whatever you believe in, to me, it's almost like nature to hear music come together like that. So thank all of y'all.
Well, Robin, I just want to ask, did you think that Krista Fanning was a fairly adequate teacher?
Fairly adequate, yes. More, she was inspirational. I don't know, for instance, if my child is even the greatest musician ever, but he loves music and he loves being part of the band. And when different, you know, different kinds of people can get together. And I tell people all the time, too, when they go to high school, even if your child isn't in the band or isn't in a musical group or performing, their lives are going to be enhanced by knowing the kids that do music. And I see that all the time, because I mean, the most important, I mean, of course the musicians are important, but it's the audience that's really important. And that's why my family always gets embarrassed when I hoot and holler, but I feel like the people on the stage need to hear the energy that they've created from their music. I guess that's kind of corny, but
no, that's not corny.
So anyway, well, I wish society places a. I mean, I personally think society we it's important to place a high value on things like medicine and things of that nature, because that's very important. But artists, we need artists as well, just like we need doctors and judges and CPAs. We need musicians. So thank you.
Well, the reason I asked Krista to come, because I'm interested in teachers and good teaching, and I think Krista is a master teacher.
Oh, well, thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank y'all.
Thank you, Robin. We have another caller from Cindy, and Cindy lives in Nacogdoches. Cindy, go ahead.
I wanted to see if you could talk about if there's a positive relationship with dance, classical dance.
Well, Dr. Nanda was just talking before we got started. I was going to, Shelley and I were going to plan a program on movement and development and so on. Dr. Nanda will have a comment on that.
Well, I don't want to sort of...
Your body's the instrument.
Yeah, I don't want to reincarnate the John Travolta movement in Saturday Night Live. But I think historically, I mean, you think of Rumi and the dervishes in Turkey. You know, they would swing and they would go into a trance. So I think dance is a very important aspect of this. And it's in many religious traditions, too, where they dance. And the dance and the music together have a synergistic effect. And, you know, dancing makes people happy. You know, mm-hmm. So I think it's like music, you know.
But you would think that dancing and music together would really promote brain development?
That, I don't have any studies. You know, it sounds intuitively right, but I'm not going to tell kids out there, start discoing or twerking to get your, you know what I mean? It's not,
yeah.
There's a little, you know, I don't think we have data on that. I think music, we have a little bit more, but I think the kind of music makes a difference. I also want to go back to one point that Robin talked about, is I think math has a real correlation with music. And kids that are good musicians tend to be preternaturally better at math. There's data on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But
But Cindy, Dr. Nanda didn't say what he was telling us just before we started the program was about posture. Anil, say something about, say what you said.
Well, I was at one of our meetings with Amy Cuddy, and she talks a lot about presence. And they say if you're slumped over and you don't sit out and sit properly, you raise your arms, deep breaths, it makes a difference on your mood. So as you notice, when I talk, everybody in this room suddenly brought up their chest.
Right. Well, everybody else did, so I felt like I had to.
Yeah.
But there's a big correlation with posture and behavior, too. So they say that, you know, you should have your chest out, deep breaths, you know, open yourself up. If you're slouched, and they call it the eye hunch, because, you know, the kids are walking around with their cell phone and they're bent over and their spines are bent over. And that in itself can be a negative inducement on mood. Mm-hmm. So your posture is very important. You know?
I think, too, when a lot of people are slumped over and their shoulders are hiding their heart, you know, they're not being as open to the world and they're kind of a light under a bushel basket, whereas if they open and their shoulders and put them back, they're more available and so on.
You just described like most sixth graders.
They're all slumped
hiding
over.
Their hearts.
Hiding their
scared.
Hearts.
Scared, yes.
Well, you're teaching seventh and eighth graders.
Yes.
So doesn't music bring their hearts?
Absolutely. It brings them right out.
Okay. Okay, good. Again, thank you both, Cindy and Robin, for calling in. We invite others of you to call in and join us, 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Nanda, did you want to say any more about in this area of the science of healing and medicine? Have you had a chance to, you know, bring to our listeners the studies that you've reviewed and so on?
Well, I think one of the concepts of brain healing is something called plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your brain is very plastic, and the really trendy term is neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. If you want to impress people at cocktail parties, you should say, I know about neuroplasticity.
Okay.
But neuroplasticity is the connotation is that your neurons, whether they've had a stroke or they've had damage, that music enhances neuroplasticity. So listening to music improves your brain connectivity. And that's why there's been all this, you know, research after stroke, you know. I mean, so there's studies to show that if people lose their language ability after stroke, so it's a term called aphasia, so you can't speak. If you try to make them sing, they will do better than if you try to make them talk.
The Maltilis group.
Right.
Yeah. So if they sing, they get recovery faster, and their ability to sing is much quicker than their ability to talk. So how you tone it. And so that's an interesting way for recovery. Again, it shows neuroplasticity makes a difference, you know.
Well, we know that language production is in Broca's area, left frontal lobe, for most 97% of the people. Is there an area for singing, or where does that come from?
It's multifocal. It's in many parts. One great thing we have is the functional MRI now.
Mm-hmm.
With that MRI, it lights up, you know, where you are. And you say, oh, this is the part that, you know, you listen to Beatles and you're like, oh, my God, it was like, you know, 1982, I was here or whatever. You know, so it brings back that memory. And so your limbic system and the memory can light up. Multiple areas will light up. A visual cortex may light up. You may remember an old girlfriend or something, you know, like, oh, I remember that person because I associated this with that. So it really, it's like a Pandora's box with music. Your brain just opens up, you know.
Mm-hmm. Any comment from you on?
We're speaking of like major healing, and on a more minor level, dyslexia. I've had students with dyslexia who, once they get involved in music and learn how to read music, their dyslexia really doesn't cease that I know of, but I know that they have an easier time in school. Because of reading music, it's a little bit more abstract. It's not really the letters that they're seeing, but it helps them going left to right.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We want to come back to that question, but I want to take a call from Larry. Larry, you're from Hudson. Speak to us.
Okay. This is in reference to what you were talking about earlier concerning stroke patients.
Yeah, Larry, go ahead.
My wife and I are both music educators.
Oh, good.
She on the elementary level and me on the college level, but we also both studied music therapy in college. My wife actually is a degree music therapist. And part of our training was to go to TIER Institute in Houston, it's Traumatic Brain Injury Institute. And we worked with a music therapist there and with a speech pathologist with people who had strokes and they couldn't speak. And as you were saying, they can sing, but they couldn't speak. And so this music therapist, in conjunction, working in conjunction with a speech pathologist, was able to incorporate information into song in replacement of words for a familiar tune. And over a long period of time, the music, they pulled the music. And these patients were actually learning how to speak using the other side of their brain. You know, the Broca's area of the brain was damaged, but there was a transfer of information to the other side of the brain, and they began speaking. So I'm really intrigued by the healing properties of music and really would like to see that incorporated more in schools, especially in resource rooms with kids that have learning disabilities, et cetera. There's a lot of potential there, and I think it's only just recently starting to be utilized.
Larry, thanks for your input. I wanted to get Krista to talk a little bit about, you know, she was talking about dyslexia. I wanted her to comment. First, I wanted you to say to our listeners what is dyslexia, because not everyone might not know what you mean by that.
Well, simply put, it's when I have a student who is dyslexic, their letters get reversed or turned around, or the words don't look like they do for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a double duty of trying to decipher the word and then figure out how it fits in the sentence. And so it takes them a little longer to learn. It's very frustrating.
And it's harder for them to learn to read.
Yes.
And reading becomes more laborious and less fun.
And then they don't want to do it, and then they get behind.
Right.
And it's very frustrating.
And what are you saying about those students who have dyslexia and music?
When they are involved in music, it's a whole brain learning in my classroom. And so there isn't anything that they have to worry about, first of all. They don't have a book in front of them where they start to get nervous and apprehensive about what they're doing. It's mm-hmm. a piece of music, and they're going to play this note, and then they're going to play this note. And so really it reinforces the left-right movement of their eyes, so they aren't worried about a word. They're just playing some music, and that transfers to me. I feel like it really just transfers to their words, because they're so used to going left to right and keeping that movement, seeing things a certain way, that perhaps words become more artistic and not so threatening.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
What about kids who have other learning disabilities, or kids who are on the autism spectrum? Do you have kids like that come into music?
I do, yeah. And throughout the years, I have had students with varying degrees of autism, and mm-hmm. all have participated in music extremely well. It's just this universal language where they can participate at whatever given level that they are at, and do so very well and grow through music. Students with asthma learn how to breathe better, and part of that has to do with posturing also. They have to sit correctly. And so, oh, see, now you sit up straight. I feel really like an educator right now. it helps with all kinds of learning disabilities, ADD, ADHD. They have to sit still. They have to learn how to manipulate this instrument. But they're constantly moving and constantly doing.
So all of these developmental kind of, I guess they're developmental disorders, but they're just limitations and so on. That kids have are all aided by music education.
By music, yeah.
You know, I don't know whether I should say this I'm going to say it anyway. You know, I was a little bit discouraged because you told me that only 350 kids out of the 1,200 kids that are at Caddo Middle Magnet School are exposed to the music programs that are offered there.
Yeah, it's really sad. It should be. I wish it was everybody. I wish every student had to take some sort of music class.
But it would have to be more than just one class, because I know you teach, you know, three levels. You know, you have a beginning, a middle, and an advanced level.
Right.
And I would assume that students benefit more if they go through all three programs rather than just one of them.
They do, but if I have to choose and they can only take one, I'll take that. Go ahead, take that one.
One's better than none.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Again, I invite you, our listeners, to call in and join us the way Robin and Cindy and Larry have, 1-800-552-8502. I wanted to ask you a quick question about this, Dr. Nanda. Krista mentioned reading left to right, and I've been reading some studies about kids using iPads and phones and focusing for long hours. And you mentioned this earlier, and that this over-focus on a small mechanical machine, the child tends to focus on the center, and that seems to inhibit his or her ability to scan left to right, which is necessary for reading, without moving one's head. Does any of that sound familiar or of concern to you?
Well, I think we're all guilty of that crime. We all want that dopamine surge. I mean, the thing is, these smartphones are addictive. The average person checks their cell phone every 3.5 minutes.
Wow.
You know, if you want to go through data detox, don't check your iPhone for a couple of hours, and people go nuts because they're always checking. So the kids are, you know, it's like on steroids because they're doing this a lot. And I think attention span is a huge problem. That's why I think you introduce children to music, it teaches them focus, or you sports. I mean, if you're a swimmer, you're not gonna check your cell phone in the pool. It's not gonna work, you know? So you have to do laps or something. But I think those activities are important to focus the brain. And I think music is a necessary adjunct because you do get a level of concentration that you're not gonna get. If you're constantly checking your phone, it's like a dopamine, there's an addiction. The efficiency experts will tell you, you're fine checking your emails every 4 to 6 hours. But most of us, me included, will check them. Oh, I gotta go check what's going on. And a lot of it is garbage, you know? But I think that's where we need to reflect and look inwards. And that's where music becomes a really, you know, a great source, you know? I mean, I give the example of Einstein. Einstein was not a great student in school. He struggled, but he was a master violinist, you know, and he changed the universe with his theory of relativity, you know, all that stuff that he did.
You know, I've read a lot about Einstein, and when he was when he would be working on some theoretical issue and he'd come to an impasse and he'd become frustrated, he would go play the violin.
Just like Jefferson did. You know, two really important people in history that made a big difference for the way we live, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, I invite you, our listeners, join us at 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Nanda, do you want to talk any more about active disease, the active disease process, and music interventions with active disease?
Well, I think Larry's point on TBI is very good, total brain injury, music helps recovery. I always encourage our patients that are comatose or have an aneurysms or a brain tumor and they're not in their right state. You know, I'll tell them, put a phone on your thing, listen to music. So I tell them, get some headphones, play the music they're familiar with, because it will uplift them, and if it uplifts them, they're going to be happier, and hopefully they'll recover faster. So we don't have real studies, but I think what Larry's doing with TBI and working at TIER and rehab centers to do this is really good work, you know, and makes a difference. I try to practice it with our patients, you know, in the ICU. I was like, put on your music that you like to listen to, because they're coming back from the twilight zone. You know, music becomes a safe harbor in the wild, stormy sea they're in. And it becomes a familiar object, and it gives them a sense of peace that it all might be okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. We talked on an earlier program, I think last year, about patients who are recovering and they're in a medical setting and they've got all these machines around them and they're coming out of anesthesia, they've had some trauma, et cetera. And it's a very difficult reentry process. It can be very disorienting and so on. And so that's a situation where you would want them to be listening to some familiar music.
And I think music, in our society, we don't talk about death. You know, mortality is something nobody wants to talk about. You know, our Medicare costs for the last three months of our lives are enormous. It's like 25% of the healthcare budget goes there. And the Tibetan Book of Dying is beautiful because they feel when the soul leaves, it should leave resplendently with music, with majesty. Mm-hmm. So there's been a real movement to move patients to hospice or to the floor and not die in ICU with all their tubes and play the music that they liked as sort of an exit thing. And that really, I think, gives a peaceful death. We use that with our terminal patients or patients that are not doing well. So listen, this is a good way to go, you know, rather than having tubes and the clank of the ICU with all kinds of things happening.
I also was reading that most physicians do not die in hospitals. They die at home.
I mean, they realize there's something so impersonal about death in an ICU. You know, I just think you degrade our humanity. It's not right with all the tubes. And, you know, we all know when the time is out. And I think we intuitively want to give some comfort, some compassion with the way you exit. I mean, it's a, you know, if you had a, everybody's life should have a majestic exit. Everybody deserves that. You know, no matter how poor, whether you're in the streets of Calcutta with Mother Teresa or you're, you know, royalty in England, you should exit with majesty. And music is a great way to do that with comfort, you know.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We have another call, and it's from Frank. Frank, you live here in Shreveport. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to follow up on the comment that a prior caller made. I've heard that some people who stutter when they're speaking don't stutter when they sing. I think there was a country singer here a while back that exhibited that. And I wonder if Dr. Nanda would comment on what's known about this. Thank you.
I have to pay tribute to Frank. Frank is a legendary marathon runner. He's done Boston Marathon like a zillion times. But I think, no, you make a good point on stuttering because, again, for a lot of like autistic kids that Krista was talking about, that they feel a comfort and they can sing because there's data on this. I don't know the latest on this, but I do know there's data that's with stuttering, singing helps, and it helps them overcome that. You know, the King of England was a big stutterer, and he had all the speech thing. That was a big Oscar-nominated movie with that. But I think music has become more important in that. And Krista, you might have some experience with stuttering and singing and stuff. Yeah,
not as much, not as much as probably many other people, but. Yeah, even students who play instruments, they're used to breathing a certain way. They're used to moving through the phrase of the music, and then their speech after they're done playing is usually a little bit more calm. But that's a very limited experience.
Thank you.
Frank, do you listen to music when you run?
No, I like to be out in nature and listen to nature, so I don't.
Okay, well, Frank, thanks for calling. Dr. Nanda, I want to ask you a couple other questions. One, you mentioned the brain and volume. You mentioned dopamine, and you mentioned connectivity and neuroplasticity. Are you saying that listening to music and so on and having that in one's life actually increases gray matter or increases white matter? Does it increase neurons that you know of, or does it increase the connections between neurons? Does the brain get bigger, and does it increase dopamine?
Well, I think you rely on data. What we know with MRI now, if you're a musician, so if you did Michael Butterman, our symphony conductor's MRI, his gray matter would be more. So he's an accomplished musician. Musicians, in fact, their gray matter is higher. So whether that translates into resilience cognitively, and, you know, we know this, like, for example, in Canadians, the incidence of Alzheimer's is 5 years later than the United States. And the only reason that is because they're bilingual. So they all speak French and English. So that if you're bilingual, you delay dementia by 5 years. So you wonder, if you're a musician, are we delaying dementia by 5 years? Are we making this delayed? So I think that neuroplasticity piece comes in very well, that if you do that, your brain is more connected. And you see this with children. I mean, if children, you have functional MRIs on them and they're musicians, they do have more gray matter there. Now, what we don't know is, does that transfer into better cognitive intellectual performance or not? I think it probably does. Intuitively, I would like to believe that, but then I am a believer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think skeptics will not accept any proof. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, our director here at Red River Radio is Kermit Poling, who is a fantastic musician. So I'm always envious of him. It's probably because he has more gray matter, I would think, don't you? So I want to ask you a very quick question here about, does music instruction accelerate brain development in young children?
Oh, I believe so. Absolutely.
Can you get the neurosurgeon to agree with that?
I think intuitively, I don't know if you have data, but I'll tell you, there's a program out of LA where they look at socially disadvantaged children, minority kids with issues at home, and they divided them into three groups. One group had musical instruction, played an instrument. Another group just was reading and stuff. The other group had nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And at 2 years, the musical group tends to do better. At 5 years, the data is still pending, but for 2 years, it is better. So we do know, even in kids that are disadvantaged, so, you know, if you're not sure your next meal is coming, or maybe music will help you become more resilient so that you can face adversity better. Because it is a wonderful escape. You know, if you listen to Beethoven's Fifth, all of us are transported somewhere. And that's, you know, it doesn't depend on your social class or your education or, you know, it's a universal appeal. It's like watching a sunset. A sunset has universal appeal.
Right.
Yeah. Well, in terms of me promoting my agenda, that's why I asked, does music instruction appear to accelerate brain development in young children? And so that's what I kind of like to sell with this program, if you will. We have a caller. Mark, you live in Houghton. Please speak up.
Yes, I'm with you.
Go ahead.
On NPR, I guess it was about a couple of weeks ago, there was a, I'm trying to remember which show it was. It's one of those after 6 o'clock shows. It's excellent. A guy had dived into the shallow end of the pool and ended up with a concussion. They fished him out and he was all right and he got well. And he went over to a friend's house a few days later and sat down at the piano. He had no idea how to play the piano. And he started playing just this incredible stuff. And he's playing classical piano now for a living. I wonder if any of you had heard of that.
That's the kind of accident we all want.
Yeah, I'd like that.
You know, you become a musical savant after a concussion.
Yeah.
This is very rare. It's reported in the literature, but it's a rare occurrence. You know, normally 99% of injuries will get you worse cognitively. You know, the whole concussion epidemic that we have in the United States with people coming back from Iraq with IEDs, with kids playing football. Concussion is a bad deal. I wish I could say, you know, my some kid had a concussion and then he became a Mozart savant. You know, I think why you read about this or heard about this is a rare case. And you don't know exactly what's going on. There's a spectrum of autism there or other issues, but this is exceedingly rare. I mean, the classic example in the neurosciences is Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage was a foreman in Boston. Explosion happens and a rod goes right through his head. He's fine, he's awake and everything, but they always said Phineas Gage was Phineas Gage no more. He started using profanities, he would curse a lot, so his frontal lobes were out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how all this localization begins. So 99 times when you have these traumatic events, it's not a good effect. But when something rare like this happens with the piano and stuff, it's like somebody like Rip Van Winkle wakes up after 5 years and it's like, oh my God, this is an awakening, you know.
Well, I almost flunked piano at the University of Memphis. I had a really good, kind teacher and I was real lucky because I was a terrible piano player. I was a good guitar player, couldn't play piano, you know, and I was I just thought that this was one of the most interesting things I ever heard.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for your call.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Krista, I want to ask you a quick question about, at what age do you recommend that children be introduced to music? And then at what age to music instruction, or at what age to actually playing an instrument? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think they can be introduced to music immediately, if not
in
before
utero?
They're born. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a big part of a kid's life. I think it's an important part of their life to listen to all different kinds of music. As far as playing an instrument, well, when I'm thinking of traditional band instruments, they need to be like fifth grade because their hands need to be a certain size. You know, playing piano, though, playing violin, playing guitar, there are smaller versions of violin and guitar that they can participate in. And piano, yeah, they can start as soon as they are able to sit at a piano and just understand that they're going to be doing something a little bit different for a few moments.
So fifth grade, did you say?
Fifth grade for band instruments, I think, is okay.
Yeah.
We start in sixth grade at CMM.
Okay. Anil, did you want to speak on that issue at all, your thoughts?
You know, I just think age, I mean, I think early exposure is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sooner the better. I mean, you know, you look at the Mozart effect, it's pregnant women with their wombs, and their babies are listening to that, you know. The new Ian McEwan book, Nutshell, is about somebody in the womb listening to all the conversations. And, you know, hears all these bad things, and you wonder if they played him good music, maybe. The outcome would be different.
Yeah. Do you know at what age is the optimal age for introducing a child to a second language?
I think they say the earlier the better. Like, you know, experience comes from Europe, where like in Switzerland, everybody's quadrilingual. I mean, mm-hmm. they just fluently go from one language to the other. And I think this issue of dementia delay is very important. That means, I think if you had to say, if a listener had younger kids, I think, you know, play a musical instrument, listen to music. I think athletics, swimming, mm-hmm. exercise. Mm-hmm. And I think another language. You know, we in America don't stress languages that much. But, you know, you're in Switzerland or Zurich, like they're speaking four languages, like there's nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important cognitive wheel that can really be moved, yeah.
And so it all happens early on. Don't have to wait till four or five to introduce a second language.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We have another caller from Ken. Not from Ken. Ken, you're from Shreveport. Speak up.
Yeah, this might not be appropriate for this show, but it's a general question on memory. Can I ask that? Or
certainly, go ahead.
Okay, well, very briefly, my brother Tom Kraft, and Dr. Nanda might know him, he's a neurologist at St. Tammany, who studies memory and Alzheimer's. But he told me working memory is not nearly the same as long-term memory, and I just want to explain from my own situation, I have great difficulty remembering a watch, a cell phone, a pair of glasses. I used to go to work and leave my glasses at home, but I can memorize. I have a dream or Declaration of Independence without any difficulty. And I'm going to hang up and listen, but explain how that works in the brain, because I'm like at both extremes. I'm one of the worst at what he calls here and now working memory, and I'm maybe one of the best at long-term, you know, just straight memorization. Thank you.
Is this along the same lines of, you know, like my husband who will have he'll see a patient with Alzheimer's who can sit down at a piano and just play amazing things?
You know, it is interesting because we know there's several kinds of memories, the short-term, the long-term. We know, like, with concussion, a lot of memory stuff comes out of concussion. You have a bad concussion, you have some amnesia for the event. It can affect your short-term memory. Your long-term memory tends to be good. We see this with brain tumor patients or stroke patients. Sometimes they have immediate recall issues, they have delayed recall issues. But this cognitive skill declines with age. We know that. So you get the one cognitive skill that improves with age, and since we're all getting older, I thought it'd be nice to talk about, is wisdom. Wisdom is the one thing that improves with age, and that an 80-year-old can recall something of immense importance that has insights much better than a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old. So that's the only cognitive skill that actually gets better with age, and that's wisdom. But I think immediate, we have issues with this, and I think this is going to be a whole new industry in terms of futurism, whether electrical stimulation of the brain will improve memory. You know, there's little electrodes you can put on. There's data now coming out. It may help. It may help with traumatic brain injury. So just like we would be in driverless cars, maybe 25, you know, people just say your grandchildren will not know how to drive because it's all be driverless cars. And I wonder if in driverless cars you'll have little electrodes in your brain. Like, I'm trying to get my short-term memory better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can see that, you know, maybe electrical stimulation, maybe dietary supplements. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think there's immense hope for that because Alzheimer's is going to be a major socioeconomic drain on this economy. You think about it, it's going to be the polio of the old. Mm-hmm. And it's going to cause huge issues because we don't have a cure. Mm-hmm. We know it's being delayed. We know the incidence is a little less now, but it's an issue.
One of the things I wanted you to comment on that I saw in your class, Krista, is that these kids that are in your music classes, they start working on an instrument, they start trying to master that, and they may be kind of outlier kids or sometimes kids who've never fed in or something like that. But all of a sudden, they indirectly become cooperative with each other.
Absolutely.
Can you?
It's a neat thing that happens in music. You know, I think all musicians understand that other musicians are working just as hard as they are, and they understand what you're going through. And you're putting yourself out there when you're playing an instrument, you know, like, you're sharing a little piece of yourself. And for a lot of these kids, this is the first time they've done that. And they learn that they can do this without fear with this group of people. It's a great self-esteem builder. And that's one of the things I hear consistently from my students. You know, thank you for helping me overcome a lot of fear. And you see those kids interact with each other. And they don't always get along. They don't always, they're not best friends all of the time. They get mad at each other just like a family. But they're still a family of musicians. It's a really interesting thing to watch happen throughout the school year.
Well, I was just wondering whether their ability to cooperate, they sort of learn that indirectly. They're all of a sudden doing it.
Right.
But they don't really know that they're doing it.
Right.
Which I think is somewhat interesting.
It's something that happens in music. It's very intriguing.
Let me ask both of you a question about listening to sad music. What are your thoughts?
I think it has a place.
Speak about that.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
you. I think it helps you work through things. You know, I think music can, you know, your brain needs to comprehend some things. You just need a little time to digest and think. And it gets, I know for me, it gets me through those things. If I'm, you know, feeling kind of down a little bit, I'll just let music guide me through that and pass along to the next happy step.
Do you have some thoughts about sad music, Dr. Nanda?
But I think we all have our down times, and I think music then becomes a necessary adjunct again because it helps you. When the whole blues movement comes out of that, you know, because it's sort of a sadness to it, and it's how you cope with, you know, with the crisis and stuff. So I think, again, I'm a believer in that. I think it helps a lot. Yeah.
We have another caller, Chris. You're from Shreveport. Go ahead and speak.
Hello, honey.
Oh boy, that's my Chris.
Oh.
Well, I just wanted to touch on some of the recollections and so on and so forth. As far as my patients, when I ask them, everybody on that board right now knows exactly what their first car was. Dr. Nanda, what was your first car?
Honda Prelude.
What year?
It was 1980, 82 model.
Okay. And then it brings them closer. I know Krista's. I don't know the narrator.
Dr. Vegan. Your first car.
Oh, hey, Dr. Vegan, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. It's a 67 Volkswagen Bug.
There we go.
Wow.
$1,903.
Mine was a Plymouth Valiant 1967. That was terrible. But everybody remembers that, and everybody remembers their favorite piece of music, and everybody remembers not only the first car, but, you know, the Price is Right. They knew the MC of the Price is Right, and it's awesome to bring them back and bring them closer. And music, and Chris is far more talented than I will ever be as far as music is concerned. But it's an amazing transformation for some folks that are, we put quotes around, demented. You know what I mean?
With the Alzheimer's, dementia?
Yeah.
That type of?
Yeah.
Well, you bring up, you suggest a good question for me to pose to Dr. Nanda and to your bride. Dr. Nanda, do you have a favorite piece of music?
Yes, I like Bach a lot, yeah.
One particular?
I like everything about Bach. And I like to bicycle ride. I come back and I listen to Bach and I'm very rejuvenated, you know.
Krista, what about you?
Mahler's my favorite composer, but Fantasy on a Theme by Thomas Tallis, mm-hmm, by Vaughan Williams. I love that piece of music. Yeah. Love it.
Thank you so much.
Chris,
you're
cutting us off, but I'm going to cut you off, okay? Because I have to thank Dr. Nanda and your wonderful bride, Krista Fanning, for both of you being here.
Well, thank you.
To our listeners, all of the seven of you called in, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners that Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. The views and opinions expressed here on Health Matters may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS in Shreveport, or the staff. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. I'm sorry, Renee. With production assistance this evening by Bill Beckett. Thank you very much, Bill, for helping us. Al Villarreal, Tim Snell, and Henry Edwards. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Join us next Thursday on Health Matters. Our topic will be senior health and fitness. Dr. Nanda, you're too young to be on that program, so you will not be invited.
I do declare, Mark.
Okay. I'm Dr. Mark Vegan. Thank you very much, listeners, for joining us this evening with Mental Health Matters.